to All Together Now. This is Eleanor Lacaine. We have two kinds of hurricanes hitting the United States these days. The first is entirely man-made, as Trump offers kind words for white supremacists, kills the Dreamers program for people brought to the U.S. as children, and tries to hide his dealings with Russia and their interference in our elections. Meanwhile, Congress must raise the debt ceiling and pass a budget to fund government this month, or the government will run out of money, default on its bills, and shut down. Our first guest, Harold Meyerson, will help us analyze these man-made storms. The second kind of storms are actual back-to-back hurricanes, as the ferocious Hurricane Irma hurtles over the Caribbean towards Florida, just 1 week after Hurricane Harvey tore through Texas, turning Houston streets into flooded rivers, and one of the most devastating disasters in our history. Our second guest will discuss the connection between these horrific hurricanes and climate change, and what communities can do to prepare for the dramatic weather challenges that we can now expect with global climate change. Up first is Harold Meyerson, one of the nation's leading political analysts. Harold Meyerson is editor-at-large of the American Prospect, one of the top political magazines in the country. He has been a weekly op-ed columnist for The Washington Post and executive editor of the L.A. Weekly, the nation's largest metropolitan weekly. You may have seen his articles in The New Yorker, The Atlantic, The New Republic, The Nation, The New York Times, and many other publications. He is here with us today to discuss the man-made political storms now hitting the country. Harold Meyerson, welcome back to All Together Now.
Always good to be here, Eleanor.
Yeah, I always enjoy your wit and wisdom, particularly now in the ferociousness of what's going on both with politics and the weather.
Yeah, although, you know, we ran a piece on the Prospect website a couple days ago by a climate scientist who, the headline was, there are no natural disasters that, you know, we, you know, mm-hmm. it's the human impact on the planet that is bringing us this ferocious weather. So in a certain sense, it's all man-made stuff. But anyway, I gather we will focus on the more immediate man-made stuff. Immediate meaning I'm in Washington, and that's where most of the man-made disasters are originating these days.
Right. No, exactly. I agree with all of that. Well, let's begin with Congress. So they returned to session this week, and they had three urgent things on their to-do list. They had to pass a budget, raise the debt ceiling, and provide emergency funding for the communities devastated by Hurricane Harvey. And yesterday, the congressional leaders from both parties met with Trump, and it looks like they reached an agreement to do all three things in one bill. So what's your understanding of what they agreed to do, and how likely are they to raise the debt ceiling and pay the bills?
Well, there's two things on that. The surprise, of course, is that there were two proposals, one from the Republican leaders, Paul Ryan, the Speaker of the House, and Mitch McConnell, the Senate Majority Leader, and another from the Democratic leaders, Chuck Schumer, the Minority Leader in the Senate, and Nancy Pelosi, the Minority Leader in the House. And Trump said, okay, let's go with Chuck and Nancy, as he referred to them. Let's go with Chuck and Nancy's proposal, which was kind of a gobsmack to one and all. And in fact, this afternoon,
a gobsmack to the Republicans and a surprise gift to
yes,
the Democrats.
Exactly. Though it is possible that Schumer and Trump, who have known each other forever since they're both longtime New Yorkers, had, you know, worked this out in advance, but it certainly came as a surprise to everybody else. This afternoon, the Senate already approved a little over $15 billion in disaster relief as part of this whole omnibus package to increase the debt limit and go with the existing budget up until December 15, which is what Schumer proposed. Now, another thing that's emerged this afternoon is that Trump and Schumer have made a separate agreement to get rid of the whole phenomenon of having to approve an increase in the debt ceiling, that this just is something that would happen automatically. From the standpoint of what we euphemistically refer to as the markets would love this, because if there were ever enough quite nutty Republicans, and there almost have been quite enough nutty Republicans, to refuse to increase the debt ceiling, that would mean the United States no longer honors its bills. And, the general perception is that the entire world capitalist system would go fluey, making mm-hmm. what happened after the failure of Lehman Brothers in 2008 look relatively mild by comparison. Now, this is an interesting proposal because, on the one hand, it's crazy that the Congress has to vote every however long it is, every 6 months, every year, every 2 years, to increase the debt ceiling, because, I mean, come on, the United States can't seriously say it's going to default on its financial obligations. That's the first thing. The second thing, though, is that if I were a Republican, I would actually welcome, I mean, if, you know, anyone should welcome this because it's a crazy idea, but from the Republicans having a vote on this and having a significant portion of their members look like, really anarchists willing to blow up the world, mm-hmm. is crazy. It's kind of what it reminds me of is increasing the minimum wage. If every time this comes for a vote with the public or in a legislature, it's terrifically unpopular to be against increasing the minimum wage. And so Republicans have avoided letting this come to a vote when they're in control of Congress, because they don't want to look like the Scrooges that they are. But what would make sense, from both points of view, is once it's raised to a significant level, to just index it to the cost of living or something like that, because that would, raise it automatically, and the Republicans wouldn't have to look like a bunch of blue meanies or red meanies, as the case may be. And the same thing with the debt limit. So the fact that, Trump and Schumer are now talking about getting rid of having a vote on increasing the debt ceiling, on the one hand, makes a lot of sense. On the other hand, a lot of Republicans are going to oppose it because that looks like maybe it's fiscally irresponsible or something or other. But, mm-hmm. They're crazy to have to want to vote on this stuff because they sort of threaten the world economic system, and that doesn't look so good. So anyway, that's my take on what is the latest news, which is this Trump and Schumer agreement to get rid of these votes altogether.
All right. Well, we got two major things in what you're talking about. The first is the omnibus bill, where they actually have agreed to award the money for hurricane relief. They've agreed to lift the debt ceiling so bills can be paid, and they've agreed to continue the funding the government and the budget with just on a three-month basis. And now the Democrats wanted the three-month renewal or continuing resolution, but the Republicans wanted it to go more like 18 months through the 2018 elections. It would seem to me if you wanted to stabilize the economy, you'd want the longer time period. Why do you think the Democrats were willing and pushing just for 3 months instead of the 18-month extension?
Well, a couple of things. First of all, since the budget is included in this, that means we go forward another 3 months without some of the draconian cuts that the Republicans would like to put through in a new budget. But secondly, on the debt ceiling, you're right. What the only reason the Democrats relished this, as it were, is what I just said. When the Republicans vote on the debt ceiling, a lot of them look utterly irresponsible. I think their further calculation, though, took into consideration the whole set of issues around DACA and the status of the Dreamers, and that coming up in December, there would be a series of major votes, and if the Republicans need the Democratic votes to extend the debt ceiling or, something like that. The deal is the Democrats will have leverage to get the DACA program made permanent, that the DREAM Act would be passed, and that the DACA recipients, of whom there are currently 800,000, would then be eligible for both permanent residency and eventually the ability to become citizens. So I think that was part of the Democrats' calculation as well. And, you know, in part, a lot of this is simply partisan gamesmanship. Mm-hmm. But in as much as it's hugely important for the Democrats, and I would argue for the nation, for the Democrats to retake the House, and depending on Trump's poll standing, the possibility that they might be able to retake the Senate, partisan gamesmanship is, at this point, sort of eminently understandable.
Yeah. Well, it is that kind of partisan gamesmanship, I think, that drives people crazy around politics.
Yeah.
I mean, myself, you know me, you won't find a more solid Democrat, progressive Democrat. But, when I thought, we had a chance to really have a budget and have the debt ceiling up for 18 months, why not go for that? That gives us the economic security we need. So I hope that their gambit pays off, but I myself would veer towards the security for the sake of the nation's economy.
Well, if we want to go one level beyond, consider that this is what Schumer was advocating as of yesterday, and that today he and Trump are talking about getting rid of having to appeal, having to repeatedly vote on the debt ceiling at all, that it just automatically goes up as the nation's financial obligations go up. So,
yep.
That's a 180 on steroids, to mix a metaphor just terribly.
Which, of course, is what they used to do, right? It used to be just a routine vote because...
Yeah, and this would eliminate... But because it's not a routine vote, what the sentiment you just expressed and... what the new, apparently, Trump-Schumer Accord is, since it's not a routine vote and since it makes the markets, as they say, nervous and should make everyone a little bit nervous,
yep.
Now they're proposing just having no necessity for a vote. It just goes up automatically, which is, creates a much more stable, sane economy. No question about it. So, like I said, this is a 180 to end all 180s.
Good. Well, I hope that Trump and Schumer's agreement does pass through. Of course, they have to get it through the Republican-controlled House and Senate. So
exactly.
We'll see if they agree. But it would be nice to just lift that ceiling. As you know, some people think, well, if they don't lift the ceiling, then that means we're going to spend less. No. The Congress has already voted on the budget, so the lifting of the debt ceiling just makes sure that we can pay the bills that Congress has already said they want to pay.
Exactly. And, what it means on the one hand for, Social Security, the regular checks the government cuts to its employees, to every Social Security recipient, all the bills incurred by Medicare and Medicaid. God knows what it would mean for all of that if the government, did go into default, or voted itself into default, actually, is what it would take. So, of course, it's absolutely crazy. But since there's a significant number of absolutely crazy members of the Republican Party serving in both houses of Congress, particularly the House, there's a huge case for just making the expansion of the debt ceiling automatic rather than putting it to a vote.
Good. Well, I hope that goes through. And by the way, I watched the press conference this morning with Speaker of the House, Paul Ryan, and I really got a sense of why they felt such a feeling of urgency on this. They thought they had through the month in terms of the debt ceiling and doing the budget, but apparently FEMA, the Federal Election Management Agency, is scheduled to run out of money as soon as tomorrow, at the latest by Tuesday, and they actually needed to lift the debt ceiling in order to give the emergency FEMA group the funds to continue to operate to dealing with Hurricane Harvey.
There you go.
So,
and now dealing with Hurricane Irma as well. So, yeah.
Right. Good.
Well, and consider the conundrum this puts folks like, you know, the Texas Republicans and the Florida Republicans who have, you know, against government spending and who voted against assistance for Hurricane Sandy because that hit New Jersey, which, you know, that's a foreign country to them. I think it was Joan Rawls who wrote a piece that, you know, and during an emergency, everyone's a socialist. And that appears to be apply even to Texas Republicans who try not to think about such things, but nonetheless is true.
Very interesting. I want to come back to that in 1 minute. I think that's a great quote. But first, I want to ask you how this omnibus bill that looks like it's going to sail through now, how's that going to impact the Republicans and the Trump effort to try to get more tax cuts to the rich? I mean, I'm just astonished they're even talking about it, the party that claims to be fiscally responsible, and yet here they are hammering away for the people who fund them, getting more tax cuts for the rich. Is this going to make it harder for the Republicans to pass that?
Well, you know, I mean, tax cuts for the rich are sort of the most fundamental element of Republican DNA, and they will find a way to do it. Does this make it harder? Yes. Does this mean they'll probably have to be smaller tax cuts than the Republicans want? Yes. But, you know, this is why they were born. This is their raison d'etre. You may recall when George W. Bush took office and the government actually briefly was running a surplus, position was, well, you know, we don't need all this money. Let's do tax cuts. And then when the economy had the downturn with the dot-com bust and with the added expenses of the Iraqi war, which was also a war of choice by the Bush administration, they came back and their position again was, well, you know, we're doing a lot of spending, but the way to really keep the economy going is more tax cuts. So, you know, it's, you know, if you have a surplus, you do tax cuts. If you have a deficit, you do tax cuts. If the sky is blue, you do tax cuts. If it's raining, you do tax cuts. So they're going to keep doing this one way or the other. But you're absolutely right that all of this recent stuff, including the huge expenses that are going to be incurred as a result of just these two hurricanes, makes tax cuts in general harder, and tax cuts for the rich in the current political climate, I would argue, are a harder sell than they normally are, just because the American people have awakened to the extreme level, partly awakened to the extreme level of economic inequality we have. So they will do something, but you're right in sort of implying that they can't get away with as much probably as they had hoped.
Right. Well, that's a good thing. I want to go back to your wonderful quote, during an emergency, everyone is a socialist. We're certainly seeing this now with Senator Ted Cruz, the Republican senator from Texas, doing an about-face. He didn't want to send money when Hurricane Sandy hit New York and New Jersey, but he's got his hand out there for the people of Texas to make sure that they get the help that they need. And I'm wondering now, I guess we have a national emergency given we've got Trump in the White House and the Republicans controlling Congress, but another parallel development, probably somewhat related to that, is that the organization, the Democratic Socialists of America, are surging. They just had a recent national conference with over 1,000 people attending, and they've got the membership is surging, over 26,000 members now. Why do you think so many people are joining DSA, the Democratic Socialists of America, and what impact do you think it will have on the upcoming elections?
Well, first of all, interest of full disclosure, I have been a member of DSA through thick and thin since 1975. So if people should understand where I am coming from to begin with, in answering that question, DSA was founded and was led, I think, very ably for many years by Michael Harrington, the guy who authored the book The Other America, who was this brilliant, charismatic intellectual. After Mike died at a rather untimely age of 61 in 1989, the organization somewhat floundered. It had never been larger than, at that point, about 7,000 or 8,000 members, but it had actually played a role in pushing some of the Democratic Party to the left. ESA had always felt it was unlike the predecessor Socialist Party, was agnostic, to say the least, about political arenas. It didn't really believe it made sense to run a candidate on a separate Socialist Party line unless there were some very exceptional circumstances. And so a lot of it was working openly within the Democratic Party. You know, the Democratic Party had moved right during the 80s and 90s, certainly. And the organization was sort of revving in neutral for a number of years. Then a couple of things happened. The broadest thing that happened is that the millennial generation emerged, if they went to college, emerged with huge debt and right in the middle of a catastrophic recession, and the economic system was in no way working for them. Things like Occupy Wall Street came along. Thomas Piketty's book on capital in the 21st century became, I would say, the most surprising bestseller in recent American bookselling history. And Bernie Sanders said he was a Democratic Socialist and running for president in the Democratic primaries. And polling began to show that, in particular, millennials, given a choice between socialism and capitalism, were coming up about 50-50, which is not the traditional American balance of power ideologically. And so all of this was going on, and DSA's membership really began to surge as Bernie Sanders ran for president on what was actually sort of a social democratic program, talking about the right to go to college for free, single-payer health care, those sorts of issues. And then with the election of Donald Trump, which was, I think a shock to everyone, possibly including Donald Trump himself, there was this huge "what do we do" moment that millions of Americans experienced, and a lot of young people in particular said, "Well, I'm going to join DSA." And the new membership of DSA, which is now about 27,000, having risen from about 7,000 in the last year and a half, that membership is disproportionately young. But, this parallels, there's a Pew poll just out today from the Pew organization that that they poll, they've asked members of the Democratic Party, are you, consider yourself liberal, moderate, or conservative? And, in 2000, the percentage calling themselves liberal was 28%. This year, the percentage calling themselves liberal is 48%. So there's a leftward movement generally within the center, the left and the center left of American politics, and within, frankly, I think within the United States as a whole. And DSA is the socialist tip of that liberal spear. Now, a lot of people in DSA think that there is a reconcilable difference between socialists and liberals, and at a theoretical level, that may be true. At a practical level, it all gets pretty mushy, in my assessment. They're part of this continuum of a movement to the left, which is a perfectly rational reaction to the dysfunction of the economy. And I when I look at the millennial generation, what I think of is the generation of the 1930s. I mean, capitalism failed then. And capitalism is in many ways failing now in a different way than the 30s. But, in terms of creating the kind of secure, upwardly trajectory economy that I was fortunate enough to grow up in the 1950s and 60s, It ain't doing that. And so I think what happened in the 30s when the socialist left was strong in this country, relatively speaking, is happening now. And it shouldn't surprise, really shouldn't surprise people.
Clay, I appreciate that. And you mentioned how shocked we all were. Yes, I think you're right, probably including Trump himself, about Trump winning the presidential election. And it's clear now, as evidence has come out over the past 8 months, that Russia definitely seriously interfered with the U.S. election, and that high-level people in Trump's campaign were talking with the Russians and possibly collaborating with them. Trump has been trying to stop the investigation, including firing the head of the FBI there, James Comey, and leaving himself vulnerable to a charge of obstruction of justice, a criminal offense. Do you think the Republican Congress will ever impeach Trump, or do you think the move by Jules Bernstein to get Congress to censure him might actually pass?
I don't think the Republicans have, the technical term is the cojones, to go against Trump because they're scared of their own voters. I have to put some caveats on that. One is we don't know what's going to come out in Robert Mueller is allowed to continue his investigation and eventually report on what he's found and indict some people. That could change things somewhat. The fact that at the moment Trump appears closer to the Democratic leadership on some narrow issues than he does to the Republican legislative leadership is obviously not going to endear him to a number of Republicans in the Senate and in the House. But I still think it is probably a bridge too far for the Republicans. And, you know, it's basically because we're so divided into, two, in many ways, very distinct, very different, very opposed camps in America today. There was one Republican congressman a couple days ago who was quoted as saying, look, Trump is an asshole, but he's our asshole. And the key word in that is our. He's theirs. If getting rid of him suggests they are kowtowing to the Democrats, to the others, they're going to stick with him, no matter what. Prognostications about Trump are usually pretty worthless. So, even though I think that's, I can't easily envision the Republicans doing that, given how weird everything, including our president, is, you should never say never.
True, and we have to wait and see what Robert Mueller, the special investigator, comes up with and what the charges are, because for a long time it looked like Richard Nixon would not have to leave office as president, but then there was enough evidence coming out that he was kind of forced to leave. So there's some unknowns there, but just so our listeners know, there is labor lawyer Jules Bernstein has a petition to Congress asking Congress to at least censure Trump, which like a slap on the wrist, and express our discontent with his practices and behaviors. If you want to join that petition and sign it, you can go to censuredonaldtrump.com, and we're going to have Jules Bernstein as a guest on this show next Thursday at 3. So we're looking forward to that. And we just have 1 minute to go, and this is unfair to ask a complex question at the end, but on your last visit to this show, you were talking about the actual program we need for Democrats to regain power and to help the country is economic populism and have fair taxation and strengthen the unions. And we just had a recent survey come out from Fox, of all places, showing support for unions is rising, particularly among Republicans. I just want to invite you with any comment you might have on that, 30 seconds.
Yeah, and there was an op-ed. He writes a joint monthly op-ed for the Financial Times and the Washington Post by Larry Summers, the epitome of the Democratic financial establishment, and it was why we need stronger unions. What was a niche concern of people like me and you a decade ago, people realize just how out of whack the economy is. And, some of them remember, oh, unions, right, don't they help workers? So it makes sense that there is, there's more popular support. The question is, can the laws be changed so that that popular support can be reflected in greater union strength?
And to do that, we're going to have to elect new members of Congress, particularly Democrats. So
yep.
That's all the time we have. Harold Marson, editor of the American Prospect, thanks so much for being with us today, and thank you for all your brilliant analysis and humor. Much appreciated.
Thank you, Eleanor.
Hurricane Harvey tore through Texas this week, dumping over 50 inches of rain and turning the streets of Houston into rivers. Americans responded with compassion and action as they used helicopters, boats, and even an inflatable air mattress to rescue stranded neighbors. Climate scientists have predicted for years that we'd experience more intense hurricanes and other major weather disruptions. In addition to immediate disaster relief, what can we do to prevent or limit the impact of these weather events? What can communities do to prepare for the dramatic weather conditions that now are inevitable? Is it possible to have severe weather without it becoming such a catastrophe? Our two guests today are on the front lines of taking action on climate change in two regions of the country. Our first guest, Mike Tidwell, is the founder and director of Chesapeake Climate Action Network in the Maryland, D.C., Virginia region. Following him will be Jennifer Gerardo, who is developing plans to deal with flooding and other climate challenges for southern Florida. First, we hear from Mike Tidwell, the founder and director of the Chesapeake Climate Action Network, a grassroots nonprofit organization dedicated to raising awareness about the impacts and solutions associated with global warming in Maryland, Virginia, and Washington, D.C. He is also an author and filmmaker who predicted the Katrina hurricane disaster in his book, Bayou Farewell, The Rich Life and Tragic Death of Louisiana's Cajun Coast. His most recent book, focusing on Katrina and global warming, is titled The Ravaging Tide, Strange Weather, Future Katrinas, and the Race to Save America's Coastal Cities. Mike Tidwell, welcome to All Together Now.
Thank you so much for having me.
Yes, well, I've been tracking your work for years, and you do great work, and, of course, timely now more than ever. Do you see Hurricane Harvey in Texas as part of climate change, or what do you see as the connection?
Well, I think that worldwide, whenever we find ourselves saying, I never saw that before, it's a pretty good indication that the weather extreme we're seeing is related to climate change. Unfortunately, we're seeing record droughts worldwide that no one's seen before. We're seeing wildfires that no one's seen before, Arctic ice melt that we've never seen before. And now we're seeing a hurricane with a precipitation volume that no one's ever seen before in North America. We're approaching 60 inches of rain in some areas. It is clear that the fingerprints of climate change are all over this, both because warming Gulf of Mexico waters give greater fuel to hurricanes, thus making them more powerful. But also, and I think what's most notable here, is that a warmer atmosphere can hold more moisture, and a warmer atmosphere causes the oceans to evaporate faster. So you have more water literally in the atmosphere all over the world. And what we're finding is storms like Harvey, while perhaps not ignited and caused originally by climate change are just making them a lot worse in terms of the sheer amount of rain that comes down. And certainly that's what we saw in Texas.
Yeah, that was an impressive display by nature. Thank you for that explanation. That really makes sense. So we probably would have had a hurricane even without the climate change situation we're in. But from what you're saying, it's the warming atmosphere and the warming waters just brings more moisture into the atmosphere. So it makes Harvey, as an example, a much more destructive storm. Is that right?
That's correct. And climate scientists have measured that just since the 1970s, the amount of moisture in the global atmosphere has gone up about 4%. We're also finding that extreme precipitation events across North America are rising in the last few decades. And it's sort of like if you take a shower in with cold water, when you get out, your mirror is not all fogged up. But if you take a shower in warm water, that air in the room you're in holds more moisture, and then that gets all over the mirror and it's all over everything. And that's what we're finding. There's just more moisture in the atmosphere because the atmosphere is warmer. And what we're also learning is that what goes up eventually comes down. And what we're finding in climate change is that it comes down in bursts. The precipitation is extreme. And now, I saw one scholar saying earlier today that the parts of Texas that are approaching 60 inches of rain, that's basically a one in a million year flood. In other words, it's just so far off the charts, no one can even comprehend it.
Right, and yet these more frequent, more intense hurricanes seem to be happening more and more, like you said, that never seen it before is kind of a characteristic of this climate change that we're now in, very much in the middle of. We're not predicting the future anymore. That, you know, the future is now. We're experiencing climate change. And I was very impressed that 2 years before Hurricane Katrina hit, in 2003, you wrote the book Bayou Farewell, The Rich Life and Tragic Death of Louisiana's Cajun Coast. You are the only one I know who predicted Hurricane Katrina. How did you know that was going to happen, and why did you write the book?
Well, For years and years, I was a freelance writer for a number of magazines and newspapers, including the Washington Post. And I had an editor at the Sunday Travel section of the Washington Post who, in the spring of 1999, asked me to go to Louisiana and write any story I wanted. It was an open-ended assignment, and I wound up having this crazy idea of hitchhiking across South Louisiana, not by car but by boat, because of the bayous and the swamps and the colorful Cajun communities along the Gulf of Mexico. I thought, wow, wouldn't that be interesting if I could just go from town to town, thumbing on shrimp boats and crab boats and oyster boats. And turns out it was possible, and I did it, and I had an amazing experience, sort of Huck Finn experience. This was in the late spring of 1999. But as I met these amazing Cajun fishermen and began to fall even more deeply in love with their food and their French language and the music, they began pointing out to me that that whole ragged soul of the Louisiana boot was destined to be wiped out by a major hurricane soon. And I asked them why, and they started to point out the fact that land was disappearing all around. And they showed me evidence of entire forests that were sinking into the ocean in South Louisiana, beaches that had been destroyed, wetlands that were just dissolving away, in part because of sea level rise, and that's a big part of it. The oceans are rising and just eroding that whole fragile flat part of South Louisiana, but also the land itself is sinking for various reasons, including because of all the oil drilling that the oil and gas industry have done under the ground that literally causes large areas of that land to sink. And so they were telling me, look, without this land, without the wetlands and the beaches and the barrier islands, we're going to be wiped out. Hurricanes are just getting further inland, and it's just a matter of time before New Orleans and the other coastal cities are just completely wiped out by a major hurricane. And so I found this very, very compelling, and I wrote this book, Bayou You Farewell, that basically just gives voice to these Cajun people, both to voice to their incredible culture, which is disappearing, but also the very land that they live on and how it's disappearing, and makes inevitable a really, really big destructive hurricane. And so they were the ones who educated me, a fellow American, about the fact that Katrina was coming. And that time in 1999, they didn't know what to call the hurricane, right? They just said a major hurricane is coming, but they were describing Katrina. So in my 2003 book, when it finally came out, that was a central theme, is that this is a fragile land, vulnerable because of human influence to a great human, human-caused disaster. And then within 2 years, that disaster came in the form of Katrina.
Wow, what an amazing story. And yes, that incredible hurricane hit in 2005. So now you're talking 12 years ago, we had the forceful impact of Hurricane Katrina. As you predicted, as the Cajun people had shared with you, they saw coming. What do you think we learned from Hurricane Katrina? I mean, that's the first time I remember such a dramatic hurricane that really kind of broke through the psyche and the news cycle in the country. About how intense a hurricane can be and how devastating it can be for some of our communities and cities. Do you think we learned anything from Katrina? Are we better prepared now to deal with these more frequent and more intense hurricanes?
I would love to say that we did learn a lot, and that Katrina was a teachable moment and the country learned some important lessons that help us prepare for and deal with and ultimately prevent future storms like this. But I think you look at Hurricane Harvey and you see that we haven't learned a lot. One of the clear messages from Katrina was that sea level rise was exacerbating the amount of surge tide that hurricanes were bringing on shore. Literally, it's almost like if you have a basketball player and a basketball court, and they dunk a basketball. That's impressive. But if you then raise the floor of the basketball court closer and closer to the basket, then those slam dunks just are easier to do, and they get, more spectacular, and then they happen more often. And that's what we're doing in terms of hurricanes now. We're literally, raising the ocean so that slam dunk hurricanes are becoming more common, whether it's Katrina, Rita, Wilma, Sandy, and now Harvey. We're just bringing the ocean closer to the land and to the cities and communities. The lesson that we need to learn from that is that is to ask ourselves what's causing the sea level rise. And obviously it's global climate change. And you would think that after Katrina and Sandy, we would have a national policy taking us faster and faster toward renewable energy. But unfortunately, we're going in the opposite direction here recently with the Trump administration at the federal level, and he's pulled out of the Paris Climate Accord. So that is the opposite of learning lessons from Sandy and Katrina. I also it's clear from Hurricane Harvey that we're still in denial about the sheer force and disruptive power of climate change induced megastorms. We have to begin asking ourselves, are many of our coastal cities inhabitable? And if so, what do we need to do to improve evacuation measures, to provide humanitarian aid faster, to build more resilient roads and bridges, and all the things that we're going to have to do if we intend to continue to occupy our coastal areas when the oceans could rise as much as 3, 4, 5 feet by the end of the century. So there are a lot of policies that we still need. One, to reduce global warming by getting off of fossil fuels, and two, to obviously do more in the wake of Harvey and Katrina to prepare for these storms in terms of the humanitarian impact.
Right, exactly. Well, we should have been forewarned with Katrina, and, you know, there's obviously some similarities and some differences there. It seems like with Hurricane Katrina, Louisiana was just, it's almost inevitable with the, all the lowlands there that hurricanes would come and kind of wipe out some of the area. With Houston, though, it seems like there's an added piece there where there's been so much incredible development in Houston and unrestrained development, like with no regulation. So you have, you know, whatever it is, 100,000 people a year moving into the Houston area and moving, you know, going wherever they wanted to go, including around those reservoirs, two giant reservoirs, which used to be out in the wilderness, now had people surrounding them. So when the reservoirs overflowed, you know, all those homes got put underwater. So it seems like, you know, some important similarities and differences there, but we need to be factoring in global climate change to everything that we're doing, and up to the point which you mentioned, which I think a lot of people will say is very dramatic, but I think you're right. We need to ask which, you know, are all these coastal communities really habitable now, given the inevitable rising of the sea levels and the inevitable mega storms that are going to be coming. And I think, you know, people are just still in denial and unwilling to look at that.
Yeah, I think you're right. I think denial is an incredibly powerful human phenomenon. And it's not just that, you know, we deny climate change and the day-to-day impacts of climate change. You know, we deny that Uncle Fred is an alcoholic and that we're in bad, you know, marital relationships or what have you. We're just masters of denial, we human beings. Unfortunately, when it comes to climate change, if we continue this level of denial, we're going to find that not just Houston is uninhabitable, but the entire planet is uninhabitable. You know, we are all New Orleanians now. We are all Houstonians. We have but one small planetary island to live on in this vast darkness of space. You know, ultimately, there is no safe shore to take us. There's nowhere to run. And we have to start dealing with these issues in a clear-eyed manner. And that involves, again, we have to get off of fossil fuels. We can't be building pipelines like the Keystone XL pipeline and the Dakota Access pipeline. We cannot bring coal back. There's no place for coal on a rapidly warming planet. There's no place for fracking. We have to make the rapid switch to electric cars and increasingly cost-effective and affordable solar and wind. And these are all technologies within our possession now. We don't have to invent any silver bullet to get off of fossil fuels. We have everything we need now. What we're lacking is policies. And that's why it's encouraging that a lot of the states are moving forward, despite Trump, are moving rapidly forward in big leaps and bounds toward clean energy, like California, like the New England states, the upper Midwest, and others. But we also have to have policies where we begin to adapt to the global warming we can no longer avoid. You know, often climate scientists say we need to avoid the global warming levels that we cannot adapt to, and we need to adapt to the global warming that we can no longer avoid. And so it's a two-step process. We got to stop making the problem worse, while at the same time we have to realistically look at parts of Houston and South Louisiana and coastal Virginia and other areas and say, look, what parts of these areas are going to be permanently underwater in the next few decades? And what is our policy? How do we equitably relocate certain populations? I mean, There are populations of Houma Indians in South Louisiana who are already looking for land to relocate to and deeper in the interior of Louisiana. There are entire populations in the South Pacific that are signing treaties with larger countries to send their populations to. And that is a sad reality, but it's one that because of our slowness to stop burning fossil fuels, we've put ourselves in a situation where we're going to have more Katrinas, we're going to have more Harveys, and we have to start realistically saying no to developers who want to build everywhere, who want to continue to build on beach lines. I mean, there are apartment and office building developments in Miami and New York City right now that are being constructed right now. The cranes are pouring the concrete right now, and those same buildings are flooding from high tides, from sea level rise. I mean, as they're being built, they're being flooded by sea level rise. It's just insane. And yet we have policies in this country that continue to guarantee insurance and zoning preferences for that kind of development. It's insane.
Right. You're absolutely right. And our next guest is going to be talking exactly about that situation in Florida with the flooding that's happening. They don't need any big hurricanes now. They're just having flooding on a regular basis as the sea level is rising. So we're going to hear more about that momentarily. But you make an eloquent and passionate plea for moving beyond denial and addressing the climate change that we're facing. And you're right. We need a mix both of preventing what we can still prevent, but dealing with what's unpreventable now. And we've already got so much of the carbon released in there. We're already having climate change impact on a regular basis. So you laid out a number of action steps to take, which are great. And I'm glad you mentioned, by the way, even though the current occupant of the White House has been trying to reverse the Paris Accord, the states, and I would add the cities, are still being heroic and moving forward in working to reduce the carbon emissions. So that's some good news. And what can our listeners do? Like, you mentioned a thing, we don't need new technology. We have what we need. We need different policies. What advice can you give our listeners? That we're educated. We care. What can we do to help address this situation?
Well, I get asked a lot by people in community meetings and church basements and high school cafeterias and people who are eager to do something on climate change. And they'll say, look, we're freaked out. You have our attention. We're concerned about, the latest Hurricane Harvey or droughts or unusual weather right where people live, and they want to know what they can do, but they caution that they can't do 10 things. Don't give them a list of 10 things to do. What is the single most important thing they can do? I get that question all the time, and my answer is always the same. Develop a relationship with one group that's fighting climate change where you live, whether it's the city you live in, at the state level, national, whatever it is, find a group and develop a relationship with that group so that you are active with that group. And the best way to do that is to simply sign up for the email alerts of that group that you have in mind. I mean, that's the organizing that I do in Maryland, Virginia, and D.C., in and all around the White House, primarily is based on emails. And as many emails as we get, and we're overwhelmed by them, it's still the number one way people find out about marches and community meetings. And so I would say, pick that group. If you live in the upper Midwest, there's a great group called Fresh Energy that's fighting for clean energy in Minnesota and the Dakotas. If you live on the Pacific Northwest, there's a great group called Climate Solutions. Look up their website and get on their email list. If you are in the Chesapeake Bay region of Maryland, Virginia, and D.C., go to our website, chesapeakeclimate.org, and just you'll see the tab, sign up for action alerts. And that way you can continue to know about things happening regularly in your community, the next city council vote, the next general assembly vote, the next big rally happening, and you'll have an ongoing relationship with that group. That's the number one thing that you can do. Get on somebody's email list.
That's great, and you are a wonderful model for what can be done on a regional basis as the founder and director of Chesapeake Climate Action Network. Why don't you talk just a little bit about the kind of work that you do in that region, just so people get a flavor of what can actually be done?
Yeah, well, what we're working on is a number of things. We have to play defense because the fossil fuel industry is still aggressively trying to move their agenda forward despite the extreme climate events that we're seeing. They want to move forward with extreme fossil fuels. So fracking in Maryland, we just banned fracking forever in Maryland. It's never going to happen. And we do have Marcellus Shale gas reserves in the western part of Maryland, but the General Assembly in Annapolis voted by huge numbers to ban it forever. So we're happy about that. In the District of Columbia, we are working with the city council there to put a tax on carbon fuel use. So there would be a carbon tax on gas for home heating, gasoline for cars, coal-fired electricity, and then that money collected from that tax would be rebated to individual residents. They would literally get an equal share carbon rebate check every month, and it's proving to be a very popular idea. We're not trying to create a bunch of additional government. We're trying to simply put a price on carbon and give the money back to residents in a very equitable and progressive way. And that could be a model for states across the country. And then in Virginia, mostly we're fighting Democratic Governor Terry McAuliffe, who supports two massive pipelines for frack gas. They're kind of like the Keystone XL pipelines for frack gas that he wants to build from West Virginia into Virginia, and it would just trigger an enormous new pulse of fossil fuel, of carbon emissions or greenhouse gas emissions in the state. And so we've got a campaign to stop that and to raise our voices all across the state of Virginia, while at the same time we're promoting offshore wind power as an excellent, excellent alternative for the state of Virginia, which has a very, very windy coastline with shallow waters right next to an excellent harbor in the form of Norfolk and Newport News and Hampton Roads. So it's an ideal industry for coastal Virginia. So we're working on solutions while at the same time fighting the last-ditch efforts of the fossil fuel industry to addict us to extreme forms of oil, coal, and gas.
Fantastic. Well, you're doing wonderful work. And tell our listeners, how can they contact you to support what you're doing, get some more information? Is there a website they can go to?
Yeah, you can reach me through my website. Again, it's ChesapeakeClimate.org. And you can send me a message that way. We're also on Facebook and Twitter. You can find us there and learn more about all our campaigns. And, you know, in the short term, I hope that your listeners, as I'm sure they've heard appeals already, but make a donation to the poor people of Texas. I just can't imagine the days on end of being wet and having a flooded home and flooded streets and just the sound of water and the sight of water and wet pets being dramatically rescued and tragically people drowning. It's unfathomable, but they're living it day to day and they need our help. So I hope that folks will join me and others in making a donation to groups that are helping the humanitarian crisis, but then start to concentrate and focus on what's causing these kind of storms. Help us fight climate change. Develop a relationship with a group in your city or your region who's fighting for clean energy and against extreme energy. You know, it's a race against time, and we're running out of time, and we need everyone's help.
That's great, and I encourage our listeners to contact you at the Chesapeake Climate Action Network. That's all the time we have. Mike Tidwell of the Chesapeake Climate Action Network, thank you so much for being with us today and for all your vital work. In case you've missed any of our programs, they're available in the archives. If you want to learn more about Breakthrough Solutions, go to thebreakthroughway.com. If you like this program, please go to iTunes and like it there. Our theme song is Let's Give Them Something to Talk About, sung by Bonnie Raitt. I'll be back 1 week from today. Thanks for joining us. This is Eleanor LeCain with All Together Now.